Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. I think the attitude of the papers today was if in doubt on an August bank holiday weekend, have a row about the budget. So the Sunday Independent, cut income tax instead of VAT on hospitality, voters demand. That's based on a poll they have inside. The Business Post have what they are calling an exclusive, and they're calling it an extraordinary intervention by the central bank governor, Gabriel McClough, who is basically saying, rethink the budget. He says, for an economy operating at full employment, we're adding more stimulus to the economy than it needs, and I would look again at what we're planning to do. The Sunday Times are saying ministers resist cuts to budgets despite tariffs, and they are Jennifer Bray and Claire Scott writing that homeowners and renters are expected to be the big winners in the forthcoming budget, with ministers resisting pressure to cut spending after President Trump's tariff deal. So a number of cabinet ministers, listen to this, have told the Sunday Times that they believe the economic outlook is only marginally worse than what had been expected, with one source saying they did not believe anything has materially changed. So there you go, relax. The Irish Mail on Sunday has a kind of a broader thing, saying that the government will push to reduce corporation tax rates to combat US President Donald Trump's crippling 15% tariff. So you know that corporation tax rates internationally, it's a pillar two of the OECD tax agreement. You'll recall that corporation taxes everywhere had to go up to 15%. And what the gist of this story is that America wants out of that now. China potentially wants out of it as well. And kind of people saying, are Europe going to be the last mug staying to the letter of the law on this, and that we should get in on it too? No, it does mean we'd be back down to only getting 12.5% corporation tax, but I suppose it's back to us being a more attractive destination. The Mirror, in common with the Vanessa White and her children, James and Sarah, their funeral is across all the papers, and they are on the front of the Irish Sunday Mirror. Finally safe, Vanessa, James and Sarah are laid to rest in County Clare Village. And the Sunday World has senior Garda on rape charges. High-ranking officer appears in court accused of three separate sex attacks on a woman as he is suspended from the force. So let's meet our panel this morning. Harry McGee is political correspondent with the Irish Times. Lisa Chambers is a former Fianna Fáil TD and now with business advisory firm Concello. Concello? Yeah. And Niamh Horrigan is a sociologist, and Scott Lucas is professor of US and international politics at UCD's Clinton Institute. Good morning, everybody.
Morning.
Niamh, will we start with the funeral of Vanessa White and her children, James and Sarah? And I mean, it's just one story that has been, there have been stories across the papers all this week of the most horrendous violence against women. I think we can say now that this was a so-called murder-suicide.
Yes, I think we can say that now.
The perpetrator is dead. The police are not looking for anyone else. So you picked the Ali Bracken piece in the Sunday Independent, again, finally together and safe, shooting victims laid to rest.
So I suppose, coming from the, I live on the Clare side of Limerick, and we've been conscious in the last couple of days at the extent of just the shock and the disbelief and the horror. I know there was the same in Fermanagh as well when this became evident. One of the points that's been, there's a couple of things I suppose that I think are important to say. I think historically, I think less so recently, but historically, we've often seen, in particular, women who may be at risk of domestic violence or coercive control as being women who are often in disadvantaged socioeconomic situations. Okay. This is very clearly not the case here. And I think in that sense, I hope there will be lessons learned from this case. It's highlighted in a number of pieces in the paper today, particularly one by Brenda Power, who highlights the similarities in some ways between the Haw case and the fact that the report on Alan Haw, there have been repeated calls by the family for that report to be released. And those calls have been resisted by the Garda Commissioner, Drew Harris. I suppose the critical piece here, Brendan, is A, what are the lessons that can be learned from the services, not just the domestic violence services, but on Garda Síochána and policing services. But the other, and it does highlight that women and indeed any partner, because there's another piece in the paper today about a man who is very much subject to domestic abuse, about any partner who's on the point of leaving a situation, that is the point of greatest risk, particularly if you're in a coercive control situation.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, where perhaps the lessons need to be learned and more needs to be done to support people in this situation.
Yeah, and we know that Clodagh Coll had been, we know from her internet history and everything, and
that's
from people she'd spoken to, that she had been thinking of leaving. And in fairness to one thing you would say about Jacqueline Connolly, her sister, who has fought a very hard battle to get that, to get that investigated properly.
Yes.
Because there does seem to be a sense, Lisa, that, if the perpetrator is dead and the family are dead, that somehow it doesn't require the same level of investigation as to what happened and everything. I think the Coll family felt they had to push very hard to get that investigated, as another murder would have been investigated.
They did, and they were right to do so. I think even since that case, and looking now at Vanessa and her children, I think we've moved forward a little bit in this space, coming from a low base. There isn't the same tendency to look back at some of the good things that the perpetrator did in their past. I think we've moved past that now. We recognise that's actually quite traumatising for the family.
Yeah.
And there is, I think there are quite stark differences between both cases, actually.
Do you think lessons have been learned, because when we cast our minds back to the initial reporting on Alan Haw, it was absolutely appalling.
It was despicable. The family have since said how traumatising that was for them to read that. And so we haven't repeated those mistakes. I think we've been quite clear to say, that the perpetrator, what they did was despicable, appalling, and the sympathies rest solely with Vanessa and her children. I think that is a marked difference in a relatively short space of time.
I
think, and looking, across the papers with not just this particular case, but Alana Idris Quinn and other cases as well that we've seen this week, where fairly significant sentences are now being handed down for violence against women.
Yeah, so talk to me about, you picked the piece in the Sunday Independent about by Emma McNenemy, Not in a Million Years Will I Forgive Him, and this is Alana Idris Quinn. And, I think a lot of people have looked at that young woman this week and thought, what an extraordinary young woman. And then you go, but she shouldn't have to be extraordinary. Like, she shouldn't have to be brave. She shouldn't have to be any of these things. She should be out living her life with two eyes and her whole life ahead of her. Now, she is doing a great job of getting on with her life, but at the same time, she shouldn't have to.
She shouldn't have to. And she's such a young woman with her whole life ahead of her. And what she's been through is hugely traumatic. And the scars and the injuries that she has sustained will be with her forever. She has to live with that. But she herself acknowledged that she had been told that, they might get 2 to 3 years, but actually it was 6 for the ringleader, as he's been called. It's not, in her view, I suppose, it'll never be enough, because it'll never take away the pain and the suffering or really be on par with what she has to go through. But it's an acknowledgement that actually the sentencing judge went further than even she expected. We look at the sentences this week for that woman that was tortured and all of the details, harrowing details that came out of that case. But very significant sentences, 8 to 14 years across the board. So I think finally we're starting to see justice being seen to be done, justice being served, and significant sentences that actually reflect the gravity of the crimes that were committed.
Okay. Yeah, because Harry, we have these big conversations in Ireland. We have these moments where we're all up in arms about something and then we move on and nothing really changes. But is Lisa right? Does it feel as if the big conversations we have had over the last few years, and people like Jacqueline Connolly advocating for her late sister, and people like Alana Idris Quinn speaking so publicly as well, does it feel as if people waking up? Yeah.
Yeah, but we learn the lesson and then we very quickly forget the lesson and then it happens again. I mean, these are not rare. I mean, they are rare, but they're not that rare of occurrences in Irish society. And I can think of a dozen similar circumstances to the Vanessa White case and the whole case going back over 20 to 25 years. I think Lisa's right in that the language that we're using around it has changed, and people now appreciate that, that There are no mitigating circumstances. Everything has to be defined by the act itself and how egregiously bad that particular act is. And it was notable this week.
And that it's not that a man cracked or, you know, something drove him over the edge or anything. Generally, there's in a lot of these cases, there's planning involved. Like.
There is, yeah. But I mean, the net effect is that three people were murdered, you know, through no fault of their own, including two teenage children. And I actually was driving down from Donegal yesterday listening to the reports of the funeral, and I'm very moved by what was said at Bearfield about, you know, that the only consolation, and it's a very small consolation, was that his mother would have a child, would have an opportunity to be laid at rest with both of her children beside her. You know, it's heartbreaking. And nothing that happened before in any of their lives, you know, can define the actual moment itself. It has to be defined by the horror of what occurred. And that's where the language should be in relation to this. In relation to Lana Quinn Idris, I'm just full of admiration for her and the way in which she has stood up to her perpetrators and stood up against that type of wanton violence, especially violence perpetrated against women. And she's become a role model and a person that other people can look up for. And I'm very glad that she has succeeded in moving on with her life, and she's able to articulate both the harm that was done to her, but also articulate how one can process that and can move on. And also, I think the fact, as Lisa was saying, the sentences were proportional to the crime, and I think that she was able to take solace from that. And in relation to the case of Natalie Ennis, I mean, that's just shocking.
Yeah.
I mean, the sadistic brutality and violence used, and the men's age range, the eldest was 55, and a few of the younger ones were 21 years of age, and the ringleader was 21. But to perpetrate such wanton violence against a defensive woman.
The Independent today, they had a casual conversation about what they get at the chipper in the middle of doing.
Yeah, it was, and sending text messages boasting about what they were doing. It was beyond the beyonds.
Niamh, it's worth mentioning as well, again, in terms of like lessons learned and everything, that Harry saying about that funeral being so moving and so dignified and everything, that like Alan Hall was buried.
Yeah.
With his family,
he was,
and with the Carl family in a complete haze, like not even realizing what was going on. It took them a couple of days to realize.
Yeah, I would agree. I think the narrative has moved on in terms of how the media has covered. I think sentences have moved on. I think where work still needs to happen though is around the policing responses in it. You know, hopefully in advance of where we get to these situations. I mean, we know already that in cases of sexualization, experiences of the legal system are re-traumatizing. That's full stop.
Yeah. Like, no, there is, I gather, a big project going on.
There is a big project.
Educate.
Right now, I mean, we're still in that situation for people who are currently complainants within the system. And the other thing is, again, for An Garda Síochána, trauma-informed policing is something
okay.
We need a lot of work to do, both for the guards and the PSNI, indeed.
OK, we're going to take a break. Harry McGee, Lisa Chambers, Niamh Horrigan and Scott Lucas staying with us. Welcome back. Our panel still with us. Harry McGee, Lisa Chambers, Niamh Horrigan and Scott Lucas. And guys, if you put on your headphones there, there's a lot about the budget across the front pages of the papers today. I just wanted to take a bit of input from an economist. So Chief Economist of the Institute of International and European Affairs, Dan O'Brien, good morning.
Good morning, Brian.
So Dan, thanks for coming on. We just wanted to get your analysis of a few of the stories floating around today. So the Business Post today have what they're calling an extraordinary intervention by the Governor of the Central Bank, Gabriel McLouf. He says that we need to rethink the budget now in the light of the 15% tariffs and other things. He says we're adding too much stimulus to the economy. I think a lot of people were surprised to see Seamus Coffey of IFAC, IFAC normally telling the government to, you know, spend less money, say kind of the opposite. I think it was last week that we should be counter-cyclical, and that actually if the tariffs came in at this kind of level, that we should actually give people back some money and try and prime the pump of the domestic economy a bit. Who's right?
It's a difficult one to know, Brendan, because this is so different and so changed. I think what we've seen in the past week is a change in the relationship with the United States after 80 years. For 80 years, there was a sort of enlightened self-interest between the United States and Europe. We treated each other, we didn't get along all the time, but we treated each other with respect. We had contracts, and those contracts went to places like the World Trade Organization when we didn't agree on things. What's completely changed now is that this is more akin to the relationship with an emperor, that the U.S. has more power and it's demanding things from us, including in Europe. And that we really don't have the power to be able to push back against that. So we have a profoundly different situation now, where any day the sort of new imperial power turns up and says, we're changing the terms of what we've agreed. We don't like your pharmaceuticals. We don't like X, Y, and Z. So we're living in a much different world than we did for 80 years.
So do we need a more austerity-focused budget to reflect where the economy could go now, or do we actually need to start giving people money and pumping up the domestic economy?
Well, I'd be very reluctant to go down the route of, you know, we've got a lot of demand in the economy already.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's the more prudent thing to do at the moment would be to rein back expectations in terms of what sort of tax cuts there are going to be, in terms of what sort of recurrent spending cuts, as opposed to capital expenditure. The capital expenditure piece should continue to go ahead because there are bottlenecks in the economy. But in terms of what the government is doing for short-term stimulus, we really don't know how things are going to go. How this will play out, even if there aren't any further changes from the U.S. side. So I think the prudent thing to do would be to keep as much gas in the tank to manage people's expectations, to say, look, this may turn out to be okay, but we really don't know, and we've less control of our own sort of destiny than
okay.
we used to, and that's the new world we're living in.
Okay, so what I'm hearing there is A, we're not sure yet how this goes, but B, an unpopular budget is what you're suggesting. Easy to know, you don't need to get re-elected, Dan. Another debate playing out, and again, this is kind of back to the populism kind of thing. The VAT reduction for the hospitality industry versus income tax cuts is on the front of the Sunday Independent today. And obviously, taxpayers want income tax cuts, the hospitality industry wants a VAT cut.
Certainly, the economic argument for giving favourable tax treatment to a non-strategic industry just doesn't exist. So I'm afraid the sector has become obsessed with this, and for many years, those of us in the economic profession have said there is just no good reason to give tax breaks to an industry that's doing okay. Of course, there are ups and downs and companies come and go, but this is not a strategic industry like pharmaceuticals or something. So giving a particular tax break to the hospitality industry makes zero sense from a whole range of perspectives. As I say, I think the government may be more prudent to say to people, we're going to manage expectations. Maybe nobody gets a tax cut this year. We've just come through a couple of pre-election budgets where there were things done. This time it's going to be a more minimalist and hold tight.
Okay. Chief Economist of the Institute of International and European Affairs, Dan O'Brien, thank you very much. Scott, you picked some of those budget pieces. So would we start with the Business Post and Gabriel McClough rethink the budget?
Yeah, I was interested in two aspects of the McClough interview. The front page interview is what you just summarized with Dan O'Brien, which I think is the question of whether the budget focuses, let's say, on the issue of demand, which would be, for example, tax cuts, or whether it focuses more on the issue of supply, which would be, for example, supportive businesses who will be affected by tariffs. And I think what McClough is saying, and I think what Dan is saying there and others are, is that, you know, not it's beyond simply do you spend more or spend less. It's where you target the support that takes place. And there's another report alongside this from PwC, which has come out this weekend, which is saying specifically to look at support for businesses, especially small businesses that might be affected by the tariffs. And I think the government may be taking that on board. What's interesting on the inside, because there's a page-long spread on further points that McClough makes, is he goes wider in terms of talking about Ireland and the EU in terms of where they are positioned on various issues that have to play out in terms of beyond the immediacy of this budget, which is in terms of competitiveness, in terms of business support, in terms of issues such as interest rates, which come in. And I think that's almost as important as the front page lead that they've gone with.
Okay.
Because let me just give one staying line to link this then to the wider issue of tariffs. The number of trade deals that Donald Trump has signed this year, despite everything we're talking about, is zero. There is no trade deal yet. There are only frameworks for deals. So when you have a chaotic and unpredictable president, you cannot plan securely on what's going to happen. You have to try to anticipate what happens, which is why I have some sympathy with where the government's going, even as we're getting these different views on which way they should tack.
Yeah, okay. And like even trying to anticipate is probably fairly difficult with Trump. So Scott is saying there, support small businesses. And if you think, what are small businesses that are in every community in Ireland that are particularly valuable out in the regions, and that you do think of hospitality. So is this the way to support small business, give them that VAT reduction?
Yeah, look, I think the government will have difficult political decisions to make. So, you know, the central bank governor, McAlouf, of course, is coming at it from an economic perspective, which you'd expect him to do. But the government have to think of the politics of this as well, and representing constituents and listening to voters on the ground. So this is not decided yet. I know Jack Chambers in the Mail on Sunday is telling John Lee that that issue is still to be resolved. And there are differences of opinion between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, the two lead parties in this. So this is still being worked out and still actively being discussed. I think there's definitely an argument for trying to support those small mom and pop coffee shops that are food-led businesses, because they are finding it difficult. Right? We know the ones that are closing in our localities. But then you compare those to maybe the bigger chains, the multinationals, the big corporates. I think the public will say, well, I don't really want my taxes to go to them, but I would like to help the small guy. So how do they manage that? Mm-hmm. And how do they separate food businesses out from maybe accommodation businesses where they're both housed in the same building? That's still to be worked out. That's still actively being discussed.
So are Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael both dug in on this? Like, is this a hill they're going to die on the budget?
No, this budget will pass, and both finance ministers, if you notice the conversations and the narrative, the way that they speak about one another, it's very respectful. Pascal Donoghue and Jack Chambers, it's a team, and they will deliver a team-led budget that's good for the country. It doesn't mean that they agree on everything, so there will be a little bit of back and forth on this. But, you know, it's a 1.5 billion tax package. If they still go with that, considering the tariffs that have now just come in, it's not an endless supply of money, and everybody wants something different. You made the point, Brendan, that people that pay taxes want income tax cuts. I don't agree with that, actually. There are lots of people that will say, actually, I'm happy to pay taxes if it's spent properly and we invest in services.
Yeah, that's, but if you put it down, if you put it down, as the poll in the Sunday Independent does today, to a VAT cut, which, and let's not forget, it was Pascal Donoghue, wasn't it, Harry, who set up this dichotomy. He said, OK, you have the VAT cut, but I'm just telling you now, there's money there for tax cuts for people and a VAT cut. If we get the VAT cut, that's a million of it gone. He put it fairly bluntly.
Yeah, trade-offs, I think, is the phrase that he used. And the poll in The Independent is interesting. You know, I mean, I think that if you ask people the question, do you want lower taxes, you know, it's almost like asking, do you think David Clifford is quite a good footballer? You know, people are always going to say yes, please. So I take that kind of finding with a grain of salt. 63% say lower taxes, only 18% want lower VAT. But the government is minded to lower VAT for hospitality and is trying to make that kind of difficult distinction that Lisa was talking about. I read some commentary in the papers this morning that perhaps what they might do is that they might reduce taxes in the budget and then look at maybe a later landing point for introducing the reduction in VAT. But trying to distinguish between mom and pop cafes and the multinationals is not going to be possible.
Yeah.
You know, you won't be able to do that.
I think one of the big challenges, to be fair, in rural communities, as so much retail has moved online, that it is actually hospitality in a lot of smaller towns and villages that is actually hanging on, and it is under pressure. And to be fair, I mean, if we look at the origins of our embrace of FDI, it was always about employment. And I think sometimes we lose sight of that. I mean, the dividend at the end of the day is about employment. It's about jobs and it's about people keeping people in communities. And there is a hospitality piece. And in many cases, hospitality is employers in places where FDI really struggles to reach.
But there are also, I think we're told there are 7 possibly hospitality businesses opening right now for everyone that closes
Also, if you reduce the VAT rate now, it's very hard to put it back up. So these are permanent decisions where you're narrowing the tax base in the midst of a lot of uncertainty in terms of, you know, the US and EU trade agreement in principle, which isn't actually, as Scott said, isn't finalised yet. So that's all in the mix as well, is but making smart decisions now that will sustain us for the next 10 years, not just for the next
year. To be fair, Brendan, I think the poll really is supporting increased spending in infrastructure. You know, the question isn't phrased as if you want a tax cut, is it an either or? Whereas actually, I don't see a massive push.
Everything's an either or.
Yeah.
Scott, the background to this then is the tariff deal, which you have invoked it already, but there's a lot of interesting pieces about it today. There is, you would say, despite what we're being told about, this was a great deal and we have certainty now, if this is certainty. But anyway, the commentariat all agree that we got turned over. You pick Leo Varadkar. Brussels has to keep America on side, but not at any cost. Should we have threatened him?
No, because I don't think the EU got turned over. And I think a lot of the commentariat with respect to them have come to a snap judgment that doesn't pick up on why.
But hang on a minute. There's no tariffs for anything coming from America in here. We've made all sorts of, I know the promises are vague about buying this and that from them and all that, and very hard to pin down. But there's no tariffs on anything coming in from here. And there's 15% tariffs being added onto anything we export there.
Yeah, let me explain why I've just said that point. The first point here is that what the EU did is play for time by agreeing to a framework. Remember that they had agreed with the US for a 10% tariff. The deal was on Trump's desk a few weeks ago and he wouldn't sign it because he's unpredictable and because he's got certain people inside the White House that want to try to break the EU. It comes down to that. So you were facing a 30% tariff just being slapped on unilaterally, which the EU, which Simon Harris would say, look, we just can't wear this. So you agree to the 15% as a negotiating point. You also then have to look at individual sectors that haven't been nailed down, such as pharma, such as semiconductors. Mm-hmm. You then actually have to deal with a very key question that hasn't been addressed, which is the 15% tariff on top of existing tariffs, such as on Irish dairy industry?
Which we're told it's not.
Which it's not, which is a key negotiating point that's being made. In other words, all of this is still in play. And that's the first thing I think that people didn't look at, is that the EU bought some time here. Secondly, I think the other thing they didn't look at is that the EU's calculation is that there's going to be some damage here, and we know that, but the first damage of tariffs is going to be on Americans. It's going to be on American consumers, American manufacturers, American importers. And they're looking at this and thinking, look, when this starts to kick in on the American economy, there's going to be political pressure on Trump. I think that
we're seeing that already this weekend in the last few days. The numbers coming out are not as rosy as we thought they were from the American economy, correct?
Absolutely right. In other words, inflation is already starting to spike back up towards a 3% figure. Secondly, and this was key, is that they revised the number of estimated jobs created in the last 2 months by more than 250,000. And Trump was so upset by that report that jobs are flatlining, he fired the head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, an unprecedented
intervention. One hesitates to use the word Stalinism, but does that feel a little bit Stalinist-y?
Authoritarian.
Yeah.
He's authoritarian. When you've got a man who not only is firing the head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, but is trying to undercut the head of the independent Federal Reserve at any point, despite the fact that the markets, corporate sector, financial sector will all tell you, that is a move that will completely destabilize the global economy. You're talking about not only an authoritarian rule, it's the emperor who not only has no real clothes economically, he's got no literacy economically. That's what you have to deal with.
Okay. Niamh, on how the deal was done, you picked a piece in the Business Post by Sarah Collins. He did it between two rounds of golf in 90 minutes.
He did. I mean, I think Dan picked up on it there. I mean, the optics were not a deal between two partners with any level of inequality. The optics were neocolonial. And I think the intent of Ursula von der Leyen...
When you say the optics, you mean the fact that she went to him.
She went to him
mansion in Scotland, exactly. essentially. And he was then layered up and sitting in his estate.
And you know, to be fair, the EU were well able to play that game as well, as we all know from 2010 when they arrived into town here. So, but I think what the strategy from von der Leyen's team was that they would give him the big win and then they would start to drill it out in the details, because the EU often operates like that. They really penalise people in the fine grain, but that hasn't played out this week, because as people have started to query, well, what does this mean? What does that mean? We're seeing increasingly diverging visions of what was actually agreed. So the intent of providing certainty hasn't provided certainty. And my own sense is that, particularly given the fact that people like Howard Lutnick and JD Vance in particular are very, very focused on the EU, I think the strategy of just let's do the big deal and then nothing to see here and we'll kill it on the detail, I don't think that's actually going to play out.
OK, this is religion we're dealing with, like, not logic. For sure. OK, Harry, you picked Jim Power. Trump is winning. Ireland's now vulnerable.
Yeah, he's not the only one. I think Eoin O'Malley said Trump is winning. And Colin Murphy gave us the phrase of the weekend, perhaps not to be repeated on a family show.
You can say it once, because it is a word in the culture.
Enshittification.
Yeah.
And he describes that it started off with tech companies when they came. They're all cuddling everything and everybody wanted to have them. And then they started charging money for everything and monetizing everything. So he's translated that to the kind of the overall culture. He said politics is beginning to inculcate that, especially in the US, so that we're just seeing a cheapening of everything. Everything has been monetized. Everything has been given a value as opposed to a worth. And I think it's actually a very apt, if crude, word to describe the process that's happening at present.
OK, so going back to our place in all this, can I ask you a question? Because it's kind of it does seem to be hanging there in the air. Like the likes of what the ministers are saying there to the Mail, they were saying it that you know,
corporation tax.
That no, not the corporation tax.
Forget about
sorry,
that.
Sorry, the Sunday Times about saying that. Look, it's fine. It's grand. There's not going to be a huge change in things. I know now that there weren't as many people around Leinster House as usual this week, but you're talking to politicians. Are they all in denial about this? Like.
They are and they aren't. I mean, you're getting briefings from the same cabinet members of different papers that show a huge subtlety in terms of the different messages they're giving to them all, because they're telling different things to different papers. And there's a sense of... I don't think they know quite how to respond. I mean, the words that they grasped were the words that were used by the EU, that it gives us clarity and it removes uncertainty. But I think neither
of which are true.
No, like. Absolutely not. And I was talking to Ed Morgenroth, the economist from DCU during the week.
Oh, yeah.
And he was talking about a deal that Trump did with Canada. And he said, this is the best ever deal for 15% tariffs. This is in his first regime. And within a couple of months, certainty, unpredictability gone, he tore it up. And he imposed even higher tariffs, because he changes his mind and he changes his approach from week to week. So certainty and the lack of unpredictability are not arguments that can be used. I was surprised that ministers are being sanguine about it. They're looking at other things. They're saying that certainty that maybe economic performance will improve during the rest of the year, and we will be in a position where we'll be able to have the same budget. But the fact remains that the summer economic statement was predicated on a no tariff scenario. So something is going to have to change between now and the end of the year.
Lisa.
And I mean, Gabriel Matlouf was talking about an economy with full employment, with a budget of 9.7 billion, 7.9 in capital, which might be justifiable, but 1.5 billion in tax cuts. And he said there's a danger that will overheat the economy. I'm not saying that what he's saying is true or will be borne out, but he is the governor of the central bank and we must listen to what he's saying.
OK, so Lisa, you're an interesting intersection where I presume you're still very well networked in the world of politics. You're now in the world of business as well. A lot of conversation about, the EU are not set up well to have these kind of things because they move slowly and they need consensus and everything. Are our politicians able for this kind of upending of the way politics is done and the world and a potential train coming at us economically and everything?
Well, I mean, this isn't a scenario we've dealt with previously. This is kind of new politics for everybody, dealing with a US administration that is as unpredictable and as volatile as the current one.
Do we need new types of politicians?
No, I mean, I understand why ministers are saying, and like I've been talking to former colleagues, why they're saying that the current agreement in principle actually doesn't have a massive impact on the Irish economy right now. If we look at our overall exports, we've got about 9% of our exports going to the US, and about 3% of those are non-pharma, okay? So that's the bit that's been hit right now, 3% of our exports. The 6% that is pharma, Goldman Sachs are now saying, because there's a Section 232 investigation that has to happen.
You're saying pharma exports to the US are only 6% of our total exports?
Of US exports, the 6% goods and services of our total exports globally, that not everything is going to the US, but also
pharma to the US is only 6%
is less than
that correct? Yeah,
yes.
That's with services included.
Services included.
Yeah.
So some of
which are a bit phantom now, let's face it.
Well, it all leads into the Irish economy and the exchequer and the corporate tax receipts that we take in. So it's part of what the money that we have to work with.
Okay.
So if we look at the 3% that's been hit right now, obviously that's difficult for those industries. But the 6% on pharma, it could be as late as 2027 before those tariffs come in, right? We don't know what's happening in that space. So right now, the impact of the Irish Exchequer is not huge, notwithstanding the impact on those sectors that are going to be directly impacted today. We also know that the EU are now drilling down into sector-specific tariffs. So things like spirits and whiskey could potentially end up with a zero for zero, which would be good for Irish whiskey. Semiconductors could also be zero for zero, maybe even going as far as chips. So if we're looking at it sector by sector, this is being worked through. And I do agree. Okay, I think there was a lot of focus on that 1 hour meeting between Ursula von der Leyen and Donald Trump as though she let the side down in some way. The deal was negotiated before she went there. It was just a tick box exercise. And there was and I have great faith in Mara Sefcovic, who was leading the EU negotiations on this. And I do believe that overall, avoiding a 30% tariff and a full on trade war, that had to happen.
Now, that was simple. The only way you had to do that was to agree to a deal.
There was nothing simple, Brendan.
There was. Everyone who agreed to a deal got 15%, unless they had a tax surplus or a trade surplus with America, in which case you got 10, I think. But basically, everyone who's not kind of extraordinary or at war with him or has annoyed him got 15%. It wasn't great skill,
there was
15% is the standard rate.
But there was pressure to retaliate because we had that list of tariffs that we were going to reciprocate with, and we didn't do that. And there are some saying we should have actually stood up and done that.
Right.
Yeah. I do actually. And there's one other bit of the puzzle here that is part of the context, and that's defence. We are weak on defence. And with the Ukraine war and the support that we're getting from the United States on that issue, I think that was part of the overall context, and it weakened Europe's position in our really, I suppose what Leo Varadkar is kind of hinting at as well. We can't really fall out with them either overall, because it's not just trade. Defence is a big part of that. And Europe is starting to get its act together on that, but we're a few years off yet being in a position to be strong in that.
Scott, just briefly before we leave this, he has the whole lot of us over a barrel on every level, does he?
No, I think Lisa raises a couple of interesting points. The first is that there were positives out of the framework, if they confirmed, that the EU got is, for example, by saying they'll invest in the U.S. energy market with purchases, they get the gas and the oil needed to be able to cut off Russian supplies as they continue to support Ukraine. By saying they'll invest in America's defense industry, they get the weapons that are needed to support Ukraine and Europe as it ramps up their defense developments. But more broadly, the key point, and I think Lisa hinted at it when she talked about the vast majority of Irish exports that do not go to the United States, is Lucinda Creighton today, who actually says, I believe on page 8 of the Business Post, which is what the EU needs to do is we need to focus now on not only the detail of this, we need to focus on the relationships with other potential trading partners or current trading partners.
Yeah, but she also says her headline is we need to call Trump's bluff, not lie down before him. And I think a lot of people... Okay, on another aspect of this before we leave it, Niamh.
Yeah.
Owen O'Malley is writing that von der Leyen has to go Sunday in there.
Yeah. It's quite a strong line to take. I think, to be fair, she is not damaged enough by the last 6 months. She hasn't had an easy 6 months. I think obviously Gaza in particular is really challenging for her, and the fact that she came out so early on to support Israel and that has just been very damaging for her. I don't think anyone can say that that trip to Scotland was a triumph. And for people in the Brussels bubble, part of the problem here is that Ursula von der Leyen has concentrated power within her own commission and with her own office very strongly. And she's made a lot of enemies because of that. So I think she's facing into a very, very challenging
The knives are out there.
The knives
okay.
are out.
She's not collegial. And the other thing is, the thing that the overall, from a political perspective, Europe is a very powerful economic bloc. But what happened last week exposes the political weakness that's inherent in the European thing. There's huge division there. And it's very hard to have a uniform approach to any big political issue in Europe, as we've seen with Gaza and as we've seen during the past week as well.
Scott, on Gaza, where are we at this weekend post the Witkoff visit?
The immediate issue that we are facing, and I think... Nisha Dolan
in the Sunday Independent
has highlighted this, is that you are facing not only the death from above, which is scores of Gazans killed each day, either by bombing or on the ground as they try to collect aid. You're now facing that every single Gazan, more than 2 million, face the prospect of starvation. The deaths are in the hundreds from starvation now. Soon they'll be in the thousands. Now, what is the broader reality beyond that? The Netanyahu government will not accept a ceasefire. I can go into the details of how they're trying to blame Hamas, but fundamentally, Netanyahu government does not want a ceasefire.
Well, do we give Hamas a free pass completely?
No, absolutely not.
All the Arab nations signed up to that letter last week, I think, all their neighbours anyway, and most of the Arab League, saying Hamas needs to give back the hostages, disarm and get out and let the Palestinian Authority take control of Gaza. Hamas have now said we are not disarming until there is a Palestinian state. So that they are blocking.
They don't get a free pass, especially because they started the cycle of violence in October 2023. But the fundamental, and I can walk you through the details of the negotiation, is it was coming down to basically the level of Israeli occupation. And Hamas were saying, look, we only want them to be in a 1 kilometer buffer zone on the border. And the Israeli plan, and this is what needs to come out, is that they're planning for a long-term occupation. That plan has been revealed. And indeed,
and is the fact that Trump hasn't stopped them, does he essentially support that plan, or is he not stopping it? Everyone keeps saying Trump could stop this with one phone call.
They support
and
him.
He's making noises about, oh, the people are hungry and you can't fake that and everything, but he's not making that one phone call, is he?
The Americans support the plan for a long-term Israeli occupation, which has been reinforced by the National Security Minister today, who says, effectively, we must have all of Gaza. Point blank, Mr. Ben-Gvir. And the reason why I say the Trump administration is supporting it is the photo opportunity by his envoy, Steve Witkoff, with the U.S. Ambassador Mike Huckabee, to the aid points, and I use that in quotes, that Israel has supposedly set up inside Gaza. Now, these are the aid points where almost 1,000 Palestinians have been killed in recent weeks.
People were shot on the day that Witkoff was at the aid point he was at on that day. People were shot looking for aid.
So people are being shot trying to get the Israeli aid through the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. All UN and NGO aid has almost been cut off, or is at least severely delayed. And what do Witkoff and Huckabee do? Huckabee puts out a tweet, which he deleted within a minute, I think because he realized he crossed the line, which says, Gazans love Trump. And secondly, Witkoff put out a glowing report on how wonderful this aid was. And why are they doing that? Because the Israeli plan is not only for the four military zones of occupation, it's to move, relocate Gazans into certain humanitarian cities where the Israeli aid would be provided.
Okay, so then the other thing that we've seen, I suppose there was two things people hoped were moving, and one was the Israeli public. Let's put them aside for a minute. Mm. What about the fact that Trump's MAGA base, did he say to somebody, it's in a private call, but it was reported, he said, a lot of my people, my problem is a lot of my people hate the Israelis now. Is there something turning there that might turn Trump, given that he is such a kind of a unpredictable character?
There are certain vocal individuals, and the one that was focused on this week was Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, who criticized the Israelis. The problem is, I don't think we'll legally get sued by this, Marjorie Taylor Greene has made statements which are very questionable about Jewish people in the past. She's also a conspiracy theorist. So I don't think the MAGA base is the problem for Trump here. I think the Gulf states have put some pressure on him.
I think a lot of the young MAGA podcasters and the likes of those people are going with their generation now, though, on Gaza, aren't they?
Steve Bannon, who was Trump's chief strategist, has criticized him, but Bannon's on the outs. Tucker Carlson, the Fox News polemicist. I don't think the pressure comes from there, Brennan. I think the other development, which is significant, which goes beyond the United States, is the international development with the recognition of the state of Palestine. Because people notice the UK, France, Canada issuing their provisional recommendations. The story that was kind of missed last week that I think is key is 17 countries plus the Arab League plus the European Union under the umbrella of the UN at a conference on the two-state solution last week and came out and said recognition of the state of Palestine is necessary if we are to deal with the conflict. The signatories are what are key here. Ireland, Spain, Norway, UK, France, all of whom have now provisionally recognized state of Palestine, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, the Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, Qatar in particular. And what you're getting is a changing of the narrative, which says if the U.S. continues to support this open-ended Israeli war, we are going to take position against it.
Okay, okay. Niamh, you picked a piece by Carl Balfe in the Mail on Sunday, just to get back to the reality as well of what is going on here. Gaza will forevermore be seen as one of the most shameful chapters in modern history.
Yeah, I think it will. I think it's the images of children starving. And I think for us in Ireland, I think there's something about a man-made famine that is particularly powerful. And I think it's one of the reasons why Irish people are so exercised about this particular issue. If you walk through most of the large Irish towns and cities on a Saturday now, you will see people out supporting. And to be fair, I think it is very important to recognise that it is the two-state solution that people are advocating here and calling for. I think the big question actually facing us all, not just as Irish people, but as member states of the European Union, is are we now moving beyond the symbolic and moving towards, like Ireland will have the presidency of the European Union from July to December of 2026. And I think now we're, you know, there is a question for the EU in terms of issues like trade.
Lisa, before we leave this, you wanted to mention Alison O'Connor's piece in the Sunday Times about the Occupied Territories Bill. And she's kind of tentatively saying we do need to interrogate this properly in terms of what it would mean.
Yeah, I think she's been quite brave actually to write this piece because it's such a sensitive topic, and it's often when we're really driven by the heart as opposed to the mind, which I think we are in this, because as has been rightly pointed out by Niamh and others, those images of children and seeing their bones, I think that's etched on all of our minds now. You'll never forget that. So I think to kind of bring it back to, I suppose, the potential economic impacts or the geopolitical impacts of this or our relationship with the EU, other EU member states or the US, and really drill into the difficult aspects of passing legislation, because ultimately...
If it's difficult for Alison O'Connor to write it in a newspaper, is it difficult for politicians as well to say... So I won't call it nuance, like, because there's no argument with what's going on there, but to have a conversation adjacent to it that is more complicated.
It's asking the questions, because I think what she...
Are politicians finding it hard to do that right now?
Oh, they are.
Experience,
yeah, no, I do think that they are. And I mean, the committee has dealt with this, the Foreign Affairs Committee, chaired by Deputy John Lahart. And you're kind of operating, really, you're working in a bit of a fishbowl, because you're really, it's this hyper-focus on a small number of members that are, you know, I suppose, quite exposed and having to give their views. And nearly maybe, and I don't know this from talking to those members, but could potentially be afraid to ask certain questions, because really the momentum is behind us passing the bill.
Okay, whereas Harry, do you get that sense as well? Are politicians afraid?
Well, it depends on which politicians you're speaking to. I think if you go across the backbenches, there's surprising, not unanimity, but there's a consensus that this should be passed. So you see that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael members of that committee have been very strongly in support of it, including services. Sean O'Farrell, the former Can Corlia, was saying it doesn't matter about the value. He said even if it's only 10 euro, it's the symbolic importance of what's going to happen. I mean, there is an economic consequence to such a bill being passed, and there is going to be blowback, and it is going to have repercussions. But the choice that's faced by the political establishment is a choice between real politic and a principle. And to me, it seems that on the backbenches, at least, most of the politicians are siding towards principles, aware of the consequences.
The principles are the real politic, though, as well, at the moment, aren't they, in terms of,
yes, of course,
in terms of what they're facing from their constituents?
Just use phrases, maybe try to distinguish. Yeah. I mean, I think within government, I think there is more of a concern because there has been some very negative comments coming from the states in particular, and it will have consequences. But I think the momentum behind, and it might have been driven by the opposition and others, but the momentum behind that particular piece of legislation is such that it would be very, very difficult for any government to stop it in its tracks.
So, God, if you could say something in 30 seconds you want to get in there, but just really briefly.
I think just have to be realistic. There is a massive campaign by the Israel lobby using the Trump administration to try to blackmail Ireland. Unfortunately, I think it's seeping into some of the well-intentioned commentary about the occupied territories bill.
Okay. We'll take a break. Harry McGee, Lisa Chambers, Niamh Horrigan and Scott Lucas staying with us. Welcome back. Our panel still with us. Harry McGee, Lisa Chambers, Niamh Horrigan and Scott Lucas. And we just want to try and get through a couple of things now in the 5 minutes we have left. So, as we mentioned earlier, there's a poll in the Sunday Independent today, conducted on Friday. And the sample size was 1,319 people. The margin of error is plus or minus 2.7%. OK, I'll just give you that. And Lisa Chambers, then I will ask you what you think as a former Fianna Fáil politician about the fact that when asked in this poll, in the upcoming presidential elections, who do you think should be the Fianna Fáil candidate, that the most popular candidate, now half the people were not sure or not interested who were polled here, but this poll suggests the most popular candidate among the half who were interested is Bertie Ahern.
Yeah, now if I'm correct, Brendan, I think there were specific names presented to those being polled as well. So just part of the context. But there's very few names we mentioned in the context of Fianna Fáil. I mean, Micheál Martin has expressly ruled himself out, right? And he's still featuring there as the number two choice for people. So, you know, Fianna
Fáil... Bertie Ahern has not expressly ruled himself out.
No, he hasn't. I think it's been talked about for years, actually, that Bertie might contest. I
don't think
it'll happen.
Think it is?
I think it's very unlikely, is my own view on it. But look, Bertie can...
No, Mary Hanafin is only 1% off Micheál Martin in this poll here. She's at 18%.
Yeah, I mean, I think those polled are probably aware that Micheál Martin has ruled himself out, right?
Yeah.
So maybe that fed into their voting preferences here.
Mary Hanafin's the only declared Fianna Fáil candidate.
She is, yeah,
so
and
far.
She's faring quite well. I mean, it's early days yet, Brendan, and as you know, this
will
is
Will they
really,
run a candidate?
I honestly don't know, and I don't think the decision has been taken.
Harry,
and they
will
really
they?
Have to decide in the next few weeks.
I think the decision will be made by Micheál Martin, ultimately. I'm not sure. There's a lot of pressure from the backbenches to run a candidate. But there are some within the leadership of the party who don't think it's a good idea. So I just don't know. I suspect that they will. And I think Sinn Féin now finds itself in a position where they'll have to take a very tough decision in relation to running a candidate. They have a Hobson's choice. They either support Catherine Connolly, who is outside the party and wouldn't align with all of their views, or else find their own candidate. And that's going to be a difficult That's going to be a difficult challenge for Sinn Féin.
So we could end up with a two-horse race here, could we?
We could end up with a two-horse race. But I think you have to remember, first of all, presidential elections campaigns are very expensive, and we're in a year after a series of elections. So political parties, I think, are counting their pennies as much as anything else. The other thing is, to be fair, presidential elections can be quite dirty campaigns, and I think that can be off-putting for people. It would be really interesting to see a short campaign where you had the left and the right basically largely here around two candidates. It would be unprecedented,
so
I think, in Irish history.
Mairead McGuinness versus Catherine Connolly, essentially.
It would be very interesting to see how that one would play out. But I think a lot will depend on where Sinn Féin land in terms of that decision.
Well, and where do you think they'll land?
My gut tells me they'll probably go with their own candidate, to be honest.
Yeah. And who would that be?
Well, Mary Lou is the one that's been mentioned. I think they would be shooting themselves in the foot to
Harry?
Run Michelle O'Neill.
Mary Lou's not going to run.
No, I don't think
okay.
so.
Okay.
But they have a quandary. Who else is there that they can find?
Yeah.
I think Fianna Fáil will probably run a candidate as well.
You think they will?
I think so, yeah.
Okay, any idea who, anyone saying names?
there's a list of names there. I'm looking through the kind of the Hollywood
Celeste. Oh, come on, what have you heard though?
Well, I mean, Mary Hanafin has put herself forward. Bertie has not ruled himself out. We've heard...
We've
heard former Commissioner Maura Geoghegan-Quinn being mentioned. We've heard Geraldine Byrne-Nason being mentioned as a possible Fianna Fáil candidate. Deirdre Heenan, the academic from Queen's University Belfast, who has a high profile. Peter Power is a person who hasn't ruled himself out. So there are quite a few people out there. But as Niamh said, to give all of their preference,
given that I've given Bertie Hearn at 24%, Micheál Martin at 19%, this is to be the Fianna Fáil candidate. Mary Hanafin at 18, Maura Geoghegan-Quinn at 17, among the people who expressed an opinion here. Niall Quinn's at 11 for Fianna Fáil, Deirdre Heenan's at 7% for Fianna Fáil, and Peter Power's at 4%. So it doesn't look like Deirdre Heenan and Peter Power are runners suggested in, by that poll.
No. But, I mean, you know, the campaign, it's I don't think Fianna Fáil will make a decision until late August, early September. And you must remember that when Mary McAleese was introduced in 1997, she wasn't that well known.
Okay.
And she was introduced quite late, but she ran a very good campaign. So they will need somebody, if they're announcing late, who is capable of mounting a very strong campaign.
And
taking into account what Niamh was saying, that those campaigns are really dirty.
Okay. Thanks very much to my panel this morning. Harry McGee, Lisa Chambers, Niamh Horrigan and Scott Lucas. It's just after 12 noon and we go to the newsroom.